Dr. Melvin, who calls himself a theoretical physicist, among many other beautiful
and has recently been dropping in for another visit from time to time. He now lives in Santa Barbara. And he is, as he said, a theoretical physicist. And he's also been around to many groups and is very open to many, many thoughts. I think partly because he has studied the universe, he has something of a universal awareness. We're delighted to have him. And Dr. Melvin, it's yours.
Thank you, Dorothy. When Dorothy wrote me some months ago about coming to give this talk, and she gave me the title, The Pros and Cons of Spiritual Teachers, my first reaction was rather enthusiastic. I thought, I said to Sophia, that's a very apt theme for me, because I have been, it seems that I've been concerned with this question for a long time. Even more fundamentally, I guess the question lurking in my semi-conscious, around that line that Tom was talking so much about, along the line he was giving us, the question for me has always been, what is God? Not that I think of it explicitly that way all the time, but I think I've discovered that that is what has animated me enormously. What is God? And in case you want the punchline, all I have found out is very little up to this point. All I can say is God is a great big fellow. But he's also enormously minute, you know. There are elementary particles and there are universes and so on. So, it's something that really concerns us very, very deeply, though some of us are ashamed to use the word God, you know, because of all the complicated thinking that has gone into being a modern person. But actually, I think what I'll do, and this, you'll forgive me for, I was doing theoretical physics up to the last moment before I came here, so you'll forgive me if I try to go in for a little definition. First, about the title. When I'm given the title, I like to have some vague idea of what I'm talking about. So the title speaks of pros and cons. Now, pro means being for something, and con, I guess, is short for contra, which is still another, which is short for contradiction. So the pros and cons then would be the for and the against, which facing the contradictions of spiritual teachers. Now, spiritual, that's a hard one. But it's clear that there's mind, and there's body, and there's the world, and the spirit seems to be that which pervades it all, which ties it all together, and is like the water that Tom was talking about so much. It's all around us, it's in us, and we so therefore it's almost invisible to us, and it contains in it the bluebird of happiness, which we also are not aware of, that it's right here at home, and so on. So that's what roughly what spiritual will mean for the moment, that which pervades everything. And teacher, well, we are all learners. We're learning from the moment we are conscious, and perhaps before that even. We're learning from everything. We're learning from our children, our parents, our grandparents, our brothers, our sisters. So everybody is a learner, and therefore everybody has a teacher. And everything teaches us, the mind, the body, the world, teaches us all the time. So how can, and life teaches us, our life, this mysterious thing we're with all the time. Now how can one be against life or against everything? That's so obviously there are, it's only pro, isn't it? But still there is this apparent contradiction that keeps coming up, the bad news that comes after all the good news we've heard about. So What are those contradictions? What is a contradiction anyway? Well, one of the things I have learned by knowing my great friend Franklin and also from my science is that there is no such thing as contradiction in the universe. There is paradox. A paradox is an apparent contradiction due to an implicit assumption. And that's the trouble, of course. There we make all kinds of implicit assumptions. So the first thing I start out with a declaration of humility, which is what every good scientist should practice. We are always making mistakes. We are always having preconceptions and postconceptions. We're always filling our minds with a lot of garbage about things, and it just isn't so. Most of the time we are wrong about in our preconceptions, in our prejudices. Certainly group prejudices are dangerous from the word go, but we all make mistakes. And one of the things you learn from doing science, hard science, is how we all make mistakes all the time. So only that what I was talking about seems to be perfect and doesn't make mistakes. Though some people think it made a mistake with the seed of the avocado or with mosquitoes or so on, but most of the time it's very perfect, really. It's amazing. But our small imitation consciousnesses of this universal consciousness, whatever it is, we do make mistakes. And I think that's the first declaration that we should make, that we don't really trust completely our own experience, nor the experience of others, nor the authority of others, because they are full of preconceptions and so on. So that's where the contra comes in. And the contra of teachers is that they are only limited, they're only finite, no matter how much more expanded their consciousness is than our own. So that's the outstanding observation I have on that. Now, it's much more subtle than that, of course, as everything becomes. There are very great positive aspects to having a teacher, obviously. For one thing, we all start out absolutely needing a teacher. When we're children, we have to walk hand in hand with our parents. And as we grow older, we walk hand in hand symbolically with our other teachers. They teach us everything. They teach us how to read, to write, to do arithmetic, to drive, to say thank you, teaching is going on all the time. So, and teaching in the spiritual realm is going on too, because it pervades everything. But when it becomes a matter of someone being specifically a spiritual teacher, a designated guru, either through lineage or through being self-appointed, that's another story. The more is claimed, the more it should be investigated. And this is the one lesson that I have learned. The higher the authority, the more it should be investigated. The president and the senators and so on have to have to maintain higher standards than the individual. There's a bit of larceny in all of them, but not all of us, certainly. But still, the higher the authority, the more it should be scrutinized, and not the more it should be believed. That's one lesson. Another lesson I've learned is that, and there again I must acknowledge my great friendship with Franklin, has helped me, because he puts it into words. When you're a Western person, there are things in the West that you must cherish. You live in the West. We have a kind of democracy, and therefore spiritual organizations, the necessary evils in some ways, should maintain a certain kind of democracy. And I think it's the failure of democracy that has often led to these scandals in spiritual organizations. So that's my Saturday afternoon sermon. Mm. Now, as to more details on these pros and contras, Well, what can I say? I mean, you all, probably many of you, know as much as I do about the techniques and the aspirations of the meditative, the spiritual life. All I can say is that I believe very firmly in experimentation. It's experiment alone that gives certainty. Experiment and a certainty, of course, in the partial sense that you know, temporary certainty, because you, in the end, you have to suspend judgment about what is really certain. But in any case, experiment alone gives us a good guide to either managing a ship, managing a house, managing a life, and in managing our spiritual life. I don't believe in theory in the most fundamental matters, namely in love and marriage and in the life of the spirit. And that's one of the reasons why we honor Franklin. He was a great experiential philosopher, not just a theorist. So experiment is very important, and that's one reason that I have I've behaved very much like a credulous fellow. I've gone into ashrams, I've lived in ashrams sometimes for long periods, and I've known several of the very famous gurus of our time rather closely, and I've been disillusioned in some ways, and in other ways I've been impressed. Well, I'm mostly impressed by their Napoleonic qualities, and not by power alone really doesn't impress me. I think physicists are not too impressed by power anyway as a group, because they know about nuclear bombs, and that's not a good thing. So, and there are powers in the spiritual realm. There are people who have enormous siddhis, spiritual psychic powers. They can do funny things like clairaudience, clairvoyance, perhaps even projecting images and so on, but of themselves. But in the end, that's not really the point, and it's even off the point. It's even a trap, as we know. So it's not the power of the spiritual teacher that we're really to pay attention to, but because he could be just a big bully. You can have a big spiritual bully. It's rather some qualities that we call holy. They are... what is holiness, anyway? When I was a little boy, I felt already that holiness was something very beautiful, and it had something to do with no ulterior motives, absolutely no use whatsoever for something, and still a love for it. So I think that's, and that's a quality that we recognize sometimes in babies. Sometimes they're squalling brats, and at other times they live in this marvelous state of ananda, of bliss, this humming stillness, this peace that passes all understanding, and which we experience sometimes too as grown-ups, when we let go sufficiently. So that's a quality that one would like to see in a spiritual teacher. But in fact, there is a statement about it that's a bit, perhaps a bit, this was a magazine given to me by a friend recently, and of course I only got to see it in the last few miles before reaching Lone Pine this morning, because of this theoretical physics that we still have to do. But there's a statement about it that is the good news, and it reads something like this. That was the is that thing?
Paraphrasing.
Well, I think that I might as well find the page, because I may be asked questions later. It's on an article that precedes a discussion of crazy wisdom. You know, the funny practices that some gurus engage in, the tantric tradition and so on. Oh yes, here it is. People far advanced towards the goal are often recognizable. There is a sweetness about them and a gentle gaiety. Indifferent to personal comfort, they are content with what comes their way, much or little. There are some three dots all over the place here, so it's shortened. They can be distinguished by one special quality, an inner stillness, which communicates itself to all comers. So this was a statement by John Blofield, the tantric mysticism of Tibet. Now, actually, many of these very successful gurus do not exhibit that quality too much. In fact, if you go into the ashram, Muktananda, where I spent some time and became something of a friend to him. He said he was an old friend. I saw pictures on the walls of his ashrams, both here in America and in India, of many holy men from India, very famous ones, and many he knew too. They were all practitioners of the crazy wisdom. They didn't seem to show this quality of gentle sweetness or gaiety most of the time. They actually were doing very strange things, but rather challenging things. One of them would put on a lot of clothes, and he would even take clothes from people, put more on, and fill his pockets with rocks, and carry an enormous load of rocks around. He had rocks in his pockets instead of rocks in his head, because his position was that that's the way people accumulate money, you know, and so on. Things like that. He was teaching by this process. Others did even stranger things and so on. So that you have to give up your preconception about how spiritual teachers operate. They operate differently in many places, and some of these men were perhaps phonies, but some of them were real spiritual teachers. Also, violence is practiced to an amazing degree in the spiritual traditions of mankind. More recently, what has become very popular and fills a new type of gossip magazine is sexual misconduct. The Tibetan gurus who came here, the Hindu gurus who came here, many of them have been involved in scandals of sexual misconduct. And on top of that, money, seduction by money, Swiss bank accounts, enormous Swiss bank accounts, 100 Mercedes, and so on. Perhaps some of you know whom I'm referring to. Rolls Royces. So anyway. No, the Mercedes is one, the Rolls Royce is another. I must keep one's gurus apart. Well, I really don't want to take a long time, because you've already listened to some very interesting and very tightly packed talks. So let me just say that to me, the key point there is that the gurus are human, and it isn't necessarily true even enlightenment, which probably means various stages of expansion of consciousness, necessarily means that their human behavior is on an elevated level. In other words, you have to accept the fact that they're not necessarily perfect beings in our sense of the word. And there's an interesting quotation here. I'm deliberately not quoting from the great people. You can take your quotations from the great mystic boys, from Buddha, and please do. I mean, be a lamp unto yourself. That's the message of Buddha, as far as I'm concerned. But let's take it from ordinary people like me and you.
The training up here.
Okay, see, in his culture, gurus are an old phenomenon. And in our culture, used cars are an old phenomenon. Yeah. All right, an Indian psychoanalyst, Dr. Sudhir Kakkar, emphasizes this point in his book, Shamans, Mystics, and Doctors, paraphrasing the Western mystic, Agananda Bharati. Actually, we know Bharat, who happens to have been chairman of the Department of Anthropology also at Syracuse. And he's a Saraswati monk, and he was a Vienna choir boy when he was born. But anyway, and he went to India and studied and became a monk. But he's an interesting secular figure. But anyway, this is a composite thought of both Kakkar, who's an Indian psychoanalyst, and Bharati, who's a sort of an adopted Indian. Mysticism is a skill that can be learned. Its practice leads to an achievement, the mystical experience, which neither confers supernatural powers or superhuman status on the practitioner, nor imbues him with any moral excellence beyond what he can acquire through accompanying efforts of a non-mystical kind, moral, artistic, intellectual. The widespread Indian belief to the contrary, there is little evidence that the mystic is somehow a better, in quote, human being because of his mystical efforts and experience. Indeed, some of the best-known mystics have been and continue to be pompous and self-righteous, woman-haters, and politically fascist. So there you have a rather strong statement. I found this I only read a little while ago, but some time ago I bought this book of Paul Brunton's notes, his posthumous notes, and many of you know that he was a very interesting, honest, super journalist who went and got acquainted with all the holy men of his time, practically, and he went through some pretty deep experiences. But he says something relevant to this in a more moderate tone. It is only after the mystic has felt human desires and known human joys, come up against intellectual limitations, suffered worldly disappointments, that he can evaluate. If he has not had sufficient experience of common life, he may not adequately assess the values indicated by mystical intuitions, nor properly understand the meaning of his mystical experiences themselves. Mm-hmm. Thus, what he gets out of both depends to some extent on what he brings to them. Mm-hmm. If he brings too little or too lopsided a contribution, then his higher self will gradually lead him to seek development along the lines of deficiency. And to compel him to make the diversion, when he fails to respond to the inner leading, it will throw the terrible gloom of the dark night over him for a time. So this may explain why many great teachers, apparently, fall from grace and so on and so forth. Now I want to end up with just two remarks. One of them is, to me, it has come after various experiences of deliberate credulity and growing up to some degree, I've come to realize that a great spiritual teacher is one who enhances your freedom more than takes it away. And that's a rare bird, but that's a good criterion, I think. And I want to say that on the other side of this coin, there's a list in this same magazine, which I read today, by Daniel Goleman, who has been a practicing guru investigator for some time. And he has a list of things which I will not read to you. They're early warning signs for the detection of spiritual blight. But they're very good. They're very good. And well, anyway, I will read the headings only. Groupthink. He's talking about the organization surrounding a teacher. Groupthink, the elect, no graduates, assembly lines, loyalty tests, duplicity, unifocal understanding, and humorlessness. Mm-hmm. And I want to say one last word, that our great and good friend Franklin Merrill Wolfe passes all tests in this respect, and both in not having any of the spiritual blight phenomena and in enhancing the freedom of all his friends and associates. Thank you.
Well, I'm glad that you brought Agyananda Bharati in, because I was going to.
He's an interesting character.
Well, yes, and I think he's on to something in the way that he looks at the moral qualities of a person independently of, or before and after, so-called zero experiences. I think he's quite right. It's been my experience also, that it doesn't change a person in that sense.
Rarely. Yeah. Sometimes there's a fundamental transformation. Mm-hmm. And as Franklin has emphasized several times, it's distinctly individual. It's mm-hmm. different for different people. There's an element that's always different for mm-hmm. different people.
That's right.
So that's another reason for not falling into this totalitarian kind of spirituality. Mm-hmm. And I think we as Westerners can contribute this scrutiny mm-hmm. and this courteous scrutiny and democracy, mm-hmm. questioning. Mm-hmm.
Can I make one comment? That's
oh yeah, please. This is just a
just because
springboard
it's a story
for discussion
about Franklin, indirectly. But I mean, I think everything you said is very well taken. I also think there's another element of that causes a lot of confusion and deception, and that is a person's expectation of what a guru mm-hmm. should be. Mm-hmm. And this is a very quick story to illustrate it. A young man came here last year who had read Franklin's books, and he traveled all the way across the country, and he expected to see a guy, levitating with a turban on his head, and that kind of image. And when he got here, he was tremendously disappointed to see a human being who's growing old and who can't dance, and so forth. And he went away after a couple of days, and what crushed him most was that Franklin would say that to him. And he'd say, I can't carry on the kind of philosophical conversation I used to. I'm growing old, I can't remember things. And the guy was crushed, and he went away. And while he was here, I felt a little defensive about Franklin. But then I realized the tragedy, it was his tragedy. He had missed something absolutely precious and vital because of this image that had blocked what was really here. Mm-hmm. And because it didn't work, he's going to go around the world looking for that guy who levitates with a mm-hmm. turban. And he may find one who turned out to be what you're talking about, and he'll be happy, at least for a while, even though the guy's corrupt in every other way, but he levitates with a turban here. So I think it's very important that when we talk about what's a perfect person or a perfect teacher, so mm-hmm. to hold our images of what we're expecting a little bit tentatively, mm-hmm. so that you see what's actually there.
That's another preconception that we have in our minds. A great American humorist, I think it may have been Artemus Ward, said something that I think you should put in the philosophy books. He said, it's not what people don't know that hurts them, it's what they knows that ain't so.
Yeah. That's right. That's very apt. It's a nice crystallization. Yeah.
Oh. I'd like to mention something along the lines of Indian spirituality and the consciousness movement in this continent, this time, and the relationship to the Eastern mysticism, as pointed out by our Anglican friend, that much of our spirituality that we find in the West has its roots in the East. I'd like to point out that the American Indian has a type of spirituality that is indigenous to this land, that it needs to be integrated with. Perhaps it is, as the Tibetan prophecy said, when the iron horse flies and rides on rails, and the Dharma will come to the land of the red man. There's something very significant in that. Mm-hmm. I think we need to look at that very closely. Mm-hmm.
Especially as we sit on this land right here.
However, I wouldn't forget the Bering Strait and where the...
Well, that, I think that is a good point that you made, because I know through our friend Evelyn Eaton that we was quite an eye-opener to some of us who studied Eastern religions and Christian mysticism, to finally have our eyes open to the depth of profound thinking and experience of the American Indian, which somehow had escaped me totally until we had contact with her.
Our friend the Anglican minister reminds me of a humorous situation. We were in India on two successive years. I was a visiting professor at the Tata Institute in Bombay, and the head of the group with which I was associated, Narlikar, is a well-known cosmologist. We were talking about a Hindu physicist who went to the United States and settled here. And he said, oh yes, and then he became an American Indian. So they were, those Indians became American Indians.
By the way, the Native Americans often will speak of Christopher Columbus discovering the Indians, and what he originally wrote in his journal was Los Indios, and Indios means in God. So he's talking about the children of God.
Indians.
But I think we shouldn't idealize it too much.
They came and decimated the population.
From what little I know, and I have an enormous respect for their worldview, and the memories, dreams, and reflections Jung tells about that experience, and also they were sensitive to the environment, you know.
Both kinds of Indians in the garden.
You had both kinds, so you know, there's a mixture of savagery and spirituality in the Indian tradition.
There was no savagery.
No, not now, but there was in the past.
In the past, yes.
It was a strange blend, and also one of the things we have to give up our fixed ideas about how those things work. They did have a strange blend.
That about Christianity, though. It's been a mixture of savagery on a mass scale.
Talking of the mixture of savagery and spirituality, would you care to comment about, you indicated, if I heard you right during your talk, that one should look for some degree of holiness in a teacher.
Yes.
What do you think of the concept of do as I say, not as I do?
Do as I say, not as I do. That's not what Jesus said. He said,
no, I know
he said the opposite.
I was wondering what you might say.
Well, you see, I have become rather more tolerant of everybody, including priests and monks and so on. I mean, they too are God's creatures, obviously. So, even theoretical physicists are God's creatures. Yes, well, I think that to a certain extent, it's probably not such a bad idea to have scriptures written by people who are not perfect, because the word has to get around. The word has to get around. And one of the qualities of a spiritual life, I don't have to tell you, you would know about it, is honesty about your shortcomings. I think there was hardly a real bona fide saint who didn't feel he was not a saint, you know. But there are also other kinds. I once talked to the wife of the man who ran the famous Pendle Hill Center, of Quakers, the intellectual center of Quakers. And she told me she had just gone around the world and she had met a mother superior at a great convent, and mother superior said to her, the more I live with saints, the more I understand why the Lord preferred to live with sinners. So that's another kind of saint.
You might be interested to know that a certain bishop of our church was described as being so heavenly minded that he was no earthly good.
So we know about that.
You were talking about.
But there obviously have been real saints. There's even probably some truth in intercession by saints. Mm-hmm. Now, if saints aren't perfect, then other people don't have to be perfect either. I mean, so I think good scriptures can be written by people who are not perfect. But in fact, they inevitably have been, I think. But there obviously is it was my job to give the bad news, but obviously there is tremendous good news too, and the gospel means that, doesn't it?
Yeah. I believe so, yeah.
Gospel, the word. Anyway, obviously there what happened to Franklin, what happens to the other, his mystic colleagues like Buddha and Jesus and Moses and whatnot, is a tremendous expansion of consciousness, and mm-hmm. so I think that's obviously in the human possibilities, but if you ask my personal feeling about the chances of it, I would say they're not very large, judging by mm-hmm. my experiences. I'm now 72 years old, and I haven't seen too many people succeed in it. I see certain flashes of it, and I've experienced it. But with most of us, the humans, it remains a penumbral thing, with occasional moments or a few hours or maybe sometimes a few weeks of this experience of total harmony, of bliss, and so on, and grace. So that's what makes us believe in the gurus, after all. We know that that it happens. But we shouldn't expect too much, either of others or ourselves. That's my feeling.
I get great comfort from the idea that we are in process of evolution and that we're not finished. I would be very upset if I were finished, and I know I'm not.
Well, both Franklin and I share a feeling about that, or a view that there are infinitely many infinities.
Yes.
And there's no, and in fact that has come into science and mathematics quite clearly. There's no end to it, and that's what you learn. I mean, as you study things in the universe, you learn where you made your mistakes, your preconceptions. You live in a village, so you think the world is one way. And then you live in a region, and you see that it's different in different parts of the region. Then you live in the continent, and you see it's different in different parts of the different regions in different parts of the continent. Then there's the Earth, and then there are other planets, and then there's the other stars and strange other large objects in the universe, and enormous energies in the universe, and galaxies and quasars, and it's continually changing our ideas and our ideas about what are the laws of nature. In other words, what we should believe about our perceptions have altered enormously in this century, and they were never foreseen before. Nobody foresaw them. The ancients, no matter how wise they were in human matters, the Upanishad seers and so on, they didn't foresee the fact that space and time are relative. They didn't foresee the nature of the micro world that underlies this world, the quantum world, which is fundamental to this world. It's entirely unexpected. Nobody foresaw that. And yet it came out of further experience, wider experience, and so on. Well, I have little doubt that the spiritual realm is the same. There's no end to it. And
does that imply there's no beginning also?
Mm-hmm. Possibly. You have the word of Buddha on that.
And Fred Hoyle.
And Fred Hoyle.
Well, but that's a question that's become a scientific question,
mm-hmm.
the cosmological question. It's now in the realm of observational science. That's a curious thing. The things which used to be philosophical questions have now graduated to, or been demoted, whichever mm-hmm. you like, to scientific questions. They can
but it
be
also
tested.
Works the other way around. Now, there are a lot of things now that used to be purely scientific questions that have become philosophical questions again. I mean, questions of the basis of how you do science. And
yes.
The nature of knowing.
I think you're right. Mm-hmm. They always were there, but people hadn't dug into the foundation. So it's going
so
both ways.
That it, mm-hmm. there wasn't.
I have a picture of the scientist and the theologian standing hand in hand, looking out over the unknown.
Yes.
It's something that haunts me continually.
Well, it's quite possible. And the intuitions of the great spiritual beings of the past are enormously evocative. There's one thing, for example, that I'd like to say here. Now I'll talk a little speculatively, but not completely. For example, there's something in modern physics that may interest you very much. Let me first preface it by saying something about Einstein. My oldest friend was his second to last assistant, and he used to bring me stories of Einstein every day. He was commuting back and forth from Princeton. And once he brought me this story. He said, Einstein said, you know, he said, 50 years ago, I introduced the concept of the photon. And now every young physicist talks about it glibly, he said, but I still don't understand it. And you know why he didn't fully understand it? And let me explain, because it's a very remarkable fact that physicists don't usually talk much about. They don't emphasize it too much, because after all, we are not riding on a photon. But to a photon, the universe is omnipresent, and it's completely all time is mm-hmm. focused, is present. It's omnipresent in both senses. I mean, mm-hmm. it's what's the word? Ubiquitous or whatever. Uh-huh. It covers the entire universe, mm-hmm. and it's covers it's all has collapsed to the one moment. Because to a photon crossing the entire universe, if it were free to do that without uh-huh. being absorbed, would take zero time. Mm-hmm. In the photon system, it's zero time. So, and also perhaps a lesser known fact to the lay public is that the entire opening of the things would close this way too. Not only is it like an accordion, you know, mm-hmm. collapsing this way, but it also closes mm-hmm. up this way. So it essentially is a point, you know. So a photon is a very good representative of God. Mm-hmm. All time, but to us is an enormous passage of time, because for a photon to cross the universe mm-hmm. would take 1,800 million years, you know, from our point of view. But to the photon, it would be zero time. Mm-hmm. And so there's a strange thing about that. Now the other thing, which is also something we don't usually make a popularization of, is the fact that in the present theories of matter, all material particles both emit and absorb virtual photons mm-hmm. all the time. In other words, we are partially creatures of light all the time. Mm-hmm. So there is a physical aspect of light is physical. It's not material, but it's physical. There's a physical aspect of us which is like godlike, you know, uh-huh. just these little entities of light. And the emphasis on light in religious tradition is interesting in that respect. Mm-hmm. So there is a sense in which, though it's a vulgarization of the spiritual idea, there is a sense in which the physical world maps the spiritual conception. But please don't take this to mean that I think that consciousness is nothing but a quantum field or something like that. I think that's a terrible vulgarization. And I don't like to hear the people talk that way, because those are metaphors. But there is some parallelism, obviously, between the two realms, and because it is all one great mysterious creation. And it certainly is mysterious.
Mysterious is the word.
Mysterious and mysterious.
You and Tom Kelly have been reading from the same book under the same lamp. It's wonderful.
Since I don't know what book it is.
Yeah, I was just watching the parallels that were emerging between what Tom was saying prior to this and what you're saying now, especially as you began to speculate. You and Tom are saying many of the same things, both of which are metaphorical, or at least meta-metaphorical, if I can use that term.
Well, no, all that I told you was really solid science.
Oh, I know. Tested. I know that.
Just
I know,
being
I know.
Translated a little bit. What I'm going to tell you now is really a personal point, personal speculation, uh-huh. perhaps future science. But uh-huh. I have been intrigued. This is entirely my own idea, so uh-huh. You must not necessarily believe it.
I don't believe anything. Suspend judgment. Believe nor not believe. That's safe.
That's it. Yeah. See, I try to improve on Pythagoras. He said, of all forms of continence, the holding of the tongue is the hardest. I have one better. Of all forms of continence, the suspension of the judgment is the hardest. Mm-hmm. Now, this is the feeling I've had for some time now, and maybe one can make this into science, is that there's some deep, mysterious connection between the sense of I-ness that Tom was talking about so much, and I, my sense of individuality. Here I am imprisoned in this little straitjacket of a body and so on, which is also very nice, and so on, but I'm localized, I'm I. There's a deep connection between that and the fact that the moment of time we are now in is just a moment, mm-hmm. you know, the present. There's some reason why we are localized in this period of time and why we are individuals. Individuality and the existence of the present moment, dividing the past and the future, are deeply related in some mm-hmm. utterly unrecognized way as yet. Well, there's one implication of that, and that's the reason I mention it, because it's obviously premature to try to make a scientific statement. The reason I mention it is it suggests strongly that part of the spiritual expansion is getting rid of the anchoring in this moment of time, mm-hmm. getting mm-hmm. and there's one case I know of which confirms that there's a Danish man who wrote a book called With the Door Open, which I read many years ago, which is a rather beautiful little book. He was a playwright and actor, a very worldly man. He loved women, he loved wine, he loved and so on. And he had this tremendous transformation experience. And it came about through the fact that he began experiencing his childhood memories, but experiencing them as real and actual and at this moment. So he got rid of the separation between the past and the present.